My name is Amy Esdorn, and I'm here at the Society of Petroleum Engineers Annual Technical Conference and Exhibition at the George R. Brown Convention Center in Houston, Texas. Today is September 29th, 2015, and I'm speaking with Nathan Meehan. Nathan, thank you for participating in this interview.
I'm glad to be here.
Great. Well, let's begin. My first question for you is, how did you get involved in the petroleum engineering industry?
Well, I went to high school and college in Georgia. It's one of the states in the U.S. that has no oil wells, no gas wells. So it never occurred to me as a Georgia Tech physics major to get in the oil and gas industry. But one summer, my brothers and I headed off from South Georgia to the Yukon, and we would stop and work every so often. We cut weed, we painted at Kmart, we did different things. But on the way back, I stopped to get a job, and the guy said, "Do you know how to operate a bulldozer?" And I said, "Well, sure." In fact, I had only operated a backhoe, and those two things are much more different than I realized at the time. But I went out to what we now would call an oil and gas location and dug what I now recognize as a frack pit. There was an oil well nearby, or gas well, I'm not sure, but the one instruction I had was, don't go near that thing. So I didn't know what it was, but it was on my, you know, on my paycheck that I was roused about one, and I dug a frack pit. So I put it on my resume, and because it had gone from July 31st to August 2nd, I put July to August, 1974, and at college, one of my physics professors told me that someone from a French-sounding company wanted to speak with me. And of course, that was Schlumberger, and they interviewed me. It's a long story, but in any event, I went on the interview, and it was very interesting. But I realized there that maybe I didn't want to be in exactly that position. So I asked the well logging engineers about other positions. And one of them said, "You should be a petroleum engineer." And I went back to Georgia Tech, interviewed with a geophysics recruiter from Amoco, and told him I wanted to be a petroleum engineer. He connected me with some Amoco people in Denver. I got to have a summer job there. And as soon as I got there, they told me, "Well, you can be an intern, but you can't be an engineer without an engineering degree. A physics degree is not going to cut it. So you need to get a master's degree in petroleum engineering." And I applied to both Colorado School of Mines and the University of Oklahoma. And because my dad went to OU, I chose OU. I got a master's degree there. And in my very first class, Martin Chenever handed out the application forms for SPE and said, "If you're going to be in the oil and gas industry, you need to be an SPE member." And boy, was he right about that. I, of course, subsequently went on with some summer jobs and went to work there in Oklahoma City. But that's how I got into the oil and gas business. It was a big change for me. When I drove to Georgia Tech, I filled my car with 19.9 cent per gallon gasoline. We had price wars back then. I don't think anybody even remembers what price wars were, but 19.9 cents per gallon. And when I graduated, I paid 75 cents per gallon. And it struck me right then, I said, you know, I might have chosen the right industry. It was pretty exciting times, really.
That's great. So you had originally gone in for physics.
That's right. I was a physics major, and when I went from a bachelor's degree in physics to a master's degree in petroleum engineering, something funny happened on my first day in Martin Chenever's class. Of course, as a physics major, I knew that gases did not behave in an ideal manner. PV equals NRT, which is the ideal gas law. I knew that wasn't correct, but of course, the physicist's point of view would be to add various terms that take care of the actual hard sphere corrections, the attractiveness that certain molecules have to each other. So we say PV equals NRT plus this, plus that, and it gets to be really complicated. Well, in Martin's class, he first wrote up, he said, "Let's write the ideal gas law." And he said, "PV equals ZNRT. And so I raised my hand. I said, "Professor Chenever, P and V and NRT, these are old friends of mine. But who is Z? And he just laughed. He said, well, it's the factor you have to multiply to get it to be correct. And I laughed out loud. I said, you're joking. And he said, no, we're not joking. And of course, we have these correlations to correct and find Z factor. Years later, I would write the HP 67 and 97 calculator programs to calculate that Z factor that were used widely throughout the industry. And we put them in the petroleum fluids pack. And my little program to calculate Z factor was quite the technical hit of the late 70s and early 80s. It was kind of funny after I'd made fun of it.
Well, you're speaking about some of the things that you've worked on. What was your favorite project that you worked on in your career?
Well, I had a lot of great projects, and I'm still getting some great projects. But the best project in my career for me involved the Carthage Cotton Valley gas field. It's located in East Texas. It's a massive series of low permeability sands. And it had been developed on 640-acre spacing. Well, I was pretty good at downspacing fields. And everybody had a feeling that we needed more than one well per every square mile. And so they let me go to work on it. I did the log analysis, the petrophysics. I did the PVT determinations. I looked at all the well tests that we'd done. And I did a series of reservoir simulations. Now, back in the day, reservoir simulation was kind of a big deal. We physically had to go out of our office, go down to the scientific software offices, and run a single well radial 3D gas model. And we paid by the run. So it was really important to get it right. And I did all this analysis, and I got to work with Hebert Cinco and a few others to improve my interpretation. And Hebert Cinco would write back to me and send me information and data. It was amazing that I was able to interface with some of the great minds of the petroleum industry. Well, after I did my study, I came back with the answer. I said, we should drill either one well every 40 acres or every 80 acres. And everyone was astonished. They were thinking 320s or maybe 160s. And so I was suggesting drilling hundreds of additional wells instead of 30, maybe 300 or 400 additional wells. They could hardly believe it. And we had to go get regulatory approval for it. It was opposed by several people, but we were successful. And of course, the predictions I made turned out to be more or less spot on. And then we would go on from the 320s to the 160s to the 80s. And eventually that field's largely developed on 40s. And then later as a consultant, I was able to work with several operators in the Cotton Valley to help design horizontal wells in the Cotton Valley with multi-stage hydraulic fracturing. So that also had some excitement because I had a great team there. We had brought together some of the hydraulic fracturing gurus that have gone on to be pretty famous. And we worked in a team there that was very aggressive and would try different things. And we tried this slick water fracturing. And I was able to co-write a paper we called Proppants. We don't need no stinking proppants. Now, the SPE actually changed the title of that, but everybody knows what it was. So I was able to present that paper. And essentially, it was introducing slick water fracturing for tight gas. And it went like crazy. I got calls and notes from people around the world who were successful at it. And ultimately, slick water fracturing in multiple stages is what made a lot of the unconventionals possible. Even when they're not doing straight slick water, they typically do partially slick water, partially conventional jobs in what we call a hybrid job. So that work that we did there went on and did greatly expanded the profitability of hydraulic fracturing. So it was a great project, lasted over years. We got to see many different people working on it, and it made a big difference ultimately in the natural gas and oil available in the U.S.
And what year was that, or years?
Well, I started on it in the early 1980s. And, of course, it continues on for decades.
And so you said that there was some disbelief having to say that, oh, well, we could drill hundreds or even 300 wells in this 1 square mile.
Not in 1 square mile, but in that field.
Right. Excuse me, in that field. And how did you deal with that? How did you?
Well, the good news was it was going to be a stepwise process anyway. So when I came in and told them, the right answer was one well every 40 acres. I said, but of course, right now we're at 640s, and the first step is to go to 360s, and then we'll go to 160s. And each time we did that, we updated our models, we got more data, and it all confirmed the original interpretation that I had. And there are parts that are on 40s and even 20-acre spacing today. Phenomenal for tight gas. Historically, oil was on close spacing, but gas was on wide spacing. And here we found a way that said, no, we can drill lots and lots of these wells. And of course, doing research for those, I learned about some work in hydraulic fracturing that had to do with fracture orientation. And some of that work led directly to what I did in my PhD thesis. I also got a chance to talk with and get to know some of the geomechanics people at Stanford. And Mark Zoback explained some stuff to me about wellbore breakouts. And it got me enthusiastic about geomechanics and the value that that technology has. And I knew then that we weren't using enough of geomechanics in the oil and gas industry. And I'm really proud to say that today, geomechanics, like petrophysics, is part of everything we do.
And so after this experience, this project that you worked on, then you went on to get your PhD, is that right?
It was in the late 80s. It was sort of in the middle of it, if you will. And we had done a couple of rounds, and we were going to keep doing some more rounds after that. Actually, you know, during the 1980s, the second part of the 1980s, it was bad. And I had gotten up to a pretty senior level. I was the most senior engineer for the Houston region. And that meant all the district engineers and many, many engineers reported to me. And I was in the unfortunate position of being the guy who decided who got let go. And the first round wasn't too difficult, but the second and third rounds, these were really painful. And I realized that I was missing something. And this was not my career. And being in line management wasn't really the thing I wanted. I liked the staff work. I liked the technical work. But I looked at an SPE paper one day at an ATCE, and I didn't understand the appendix. It was all in Laplace space, and I said, I've forgotten that stuff, if I ever knew it. And my wife and I said, we should go back and do a PhD. And Scott Kramer helped me go back to get a PhD. He was a great influence in my life. And I was able to go to Stanford, and that decision has been the best one of my career. I'm embarrassed to say it, but I actually have kind of a graph of how much money I've made over time. And after that PhD was a big improvement. It wasn't because I went into research or development, but it was also a big improvement in fun. I got a chance to do more fun projects essentially because of that exposure, that credential, than I had previously. And I still have lots of friends that are from the faculty days or from the student days or people that I've met subsequently. It was a great decision. So if Cotton Valley was my favorite project, the best decision was going back and getting a PhD.
That's great. So you mentioned some people like Scott Kramer who, you know, really encouraged you to go back and get your PhD. Who were some of your mentors that you've had?
No, there's no question. Scott Kramer was my mentor. Scott Kramer is a former president of SPE, and most of the people who worked on him would have used adjectives like crusty or to describe him. He was not a guy that was super slap you on the back, friendly kind of person until you got to know him, and he was really a fun guy. He was an Aggie's Aggie. I mean, he was really an Aggie, and he loved his school. But he loved petroleum engineering. He loved the oil and gas industry. He had a long history with Amoco and was an SPE president who loved the society. And he not only encouraged me to go back and get a PhD, he made it possible. I had 4 children. And before I finished my PhD, I had a 5th. And I lived in a big house, and we were kind of used to having nice things. And he told me this. He said, "Nathan, I've sent a lot of people back to PhDs, and I always ask them the same story. When you're 40 years old, if you don't get this PhD, will you regret it? And if the answer to that is yes, you go back and get a PhD, whether we support you or not, because it's not worth living your life with regrets." And I can hear that like it was yesterday. And I talked to my wife, and we both said, "No, I think I would regret it." And he did make it possible for UPR to provide a little support, enough for us to get by on. And it was a great time. While we were there, my wife got a master's degree, and I had had 4 daughters. And so she got pregnant at Stanford, and we had our first son. And so we got all kinds of bonuses from getting a PhD. But Scott was my mentor. When I wanted to be a distinguished lecturer, he put in a good word for me, and he was entirely supportive. When I wanted to be on the SP Board of Directors, he said, "I can get you in." He says, "I'll write you a letter." And I said, "Do I need some other letters?" And he says, "If my letter's not good enough to get you in, then you don't deserve to be on the board," which is kind of funny. But I knew then many of the SP presidents, and I'm privileged to have known all of the living presidents of SPE, the past presidents of SPE. Some I know better than others, but I believe, look at the list, I knew every single one of the currently living presidents. And many of them were influences on me. I had a chance to be on the board, and I made a lot of great friends there, worked on lots of committees, and got to travel the world as a DL. And it really was tremendously fun. I learned more than I taught, I think. So that was really my mentor, was Scott Kramer.
And so how did you sort of meet him and work with him, and how did he evolve into your mentor?
Well, when I first met him, I was an engineer in South Texas. And he came down to visit, and I had just taken a downhole fluid sample. And my boss down there wanted me to explain downhole fluid sampling to him. And so I said, "Well, we took downhole fluid samples for this well." And he immediately asked a question and said, "How many times did you have to take it before the bubble point came out the same?" I said, 4. And it was clear to me I didn't have to explain anything about technology to the man. In any event, he saw fit that I got promoted almost immediately to district engineer. And then I became division engineer. And then I became region engineer. And in the way we ran that company, we had a committee that reviewed all the AFEs. And the region engineer sat right by him. So I would sit right by him. And when something came down to a vote, he would go around and ask every single person that was sort of had a seat at the table. And I was the last one to vote. And on the very first AFE, I voted no when everybody else voted yes. And he said, "Well, why?" And I said, "Well, this, and this." I explained it. And he said, "I agree." He says, "Send it back. You got to do a better deal." And I was perspiring like crazy. But he would bring me into his office. And I'm going to do a terrible Scott Kramer impersonation. He'd go, "Meehan, get in here in my office." That's about what it sounded like sometimes. And I got down. I would sit there, and people would make presentations. And sometimes it would be about like natural gas prices and marketing things and stuff way outside of my bailiwick. And then he would turn to me and say, "What do you think?" He came to me one time, and the gas people had brought a project, and they were offering to let two closely related parties balance gas over an underage back in the take-or-pay days between the two parties. And they had already negotiated the deal and were ready to sign off. And he said, "Man, what do you think?" I said, "Well, frankly, I'd rather be able to take our share. If one of those parties can't take their share, I'd like to be able to take it. And, you know, our proportionate share." And he said, "That's exactly right." And so now I was wrong plenty, and he let me know it. But he didn't let me know it just sort of in front of everybody. He would come back and he would say, "The right way to do this is this. You know, here's the right principle." And he taught with principles. And he would, one time, one of the parties decided to go non-consent on an exploration well. And you could tell that they didn't want to. And he called me in there and he said, "Let's call them back." And they said, "Yeah, we've gone non-consent." And the guy says, "I think we shouldn't have." And he says, "Okay, if you want back in, you're back in." Because the well had just spud. And he said, "You need to treat other people like you want to be treated yourself." And he did it in real business. When I negotiated a deal between Amoco and us that was a lot big dollar item, he said, "Well, is this a deal that you would take if you were them?" I said, "Yeah, I really believe I'd take it. And it's a good deal for us." He says, I think so. He says, I'd like to have a better deal for us, but any better, I don't think they'd take." And so he took it to them, and they made that deal. And it solved a big problem for us that would have been a huge court fight. And he explained to me sort of the principles that you do business by. And he was a man of honor. And again, an Aggie's Aggie.
That's great. So how has being an SPE member affected your career?
Well, being an SPE member has been a huge plus for my career. I started out as just an SPE member there at Oklahoma University, and they told me about the monthly meetings up in Oklahoma City. So I decided to go every month. And within a few months, I met Mike Fedkovich and Hank Ramey. These were, I mean, legends. And I got to know them, and I got to communicate with them, and they became friends for the rest of my life. It was amazing. I couldn't believe that we could actually talk to the famous people. And so it inspired me to try to do things technically and try to think like they thought. And then ultimately I got on committees and I went to SPE forums. And wow, the forums. I got to be on a forum once when I was really early in my career. I was way too early to qualify for that forum. And I don't know why they let me in. But I met all these famous people, and now these famous people are all my friends, but it was amazing to me to see the level they thought and the advances they were going on, because what they were talking about then essentially became the literature over the next 5 or 6 years, and it was exciting. So I got to meet people that were involved in hydraulic fracturing and well testing and the earliest business of simulation and water flooding, and it was amazing. But the biggest impact was not when I was distinguished lecturer. It was not when I was on the board. It was when I decided to become a consultant, because almost all of the big projects that I had came about because of relationships I developed in SPE. You know, a friend of mine I met from SPE called me up one day and said, "Hey, I've bought a well. Our client of mine has bought a well, and we have a question about it. And we know that you worked Austin Chalk, so tell me about how we should do this." And I spent an hour or two with him, And they came up with a plan. And he said, well, send me a bill for your time. And I said, no, I'm not going to send you a bill for 2 hours. Just keep me in mind for another project. And it was but a few months that he called me back and said, look, I've got a project. Unfortunately, I'm conflicted out. I want to see if you're interested. And it was the biggest project in my entire consulting career. It made me more money in, 5 months than I made in the previous 2 years. It was awesome. And it only would have come about from the fact that I was a friend of his from SPE. And so that kept happening. Being an SPE member was essential for that. And so, my wife and I had a long desire to go back and do some humanitarian work. So we left Baker Hughes for a year and a half, moved to Hong Kong, and coordinated our church's humanitarian projects in Asia. And so we did water projects and wheelchair projects, neonatal resuscitation projects, and trained a lot of people in many different countries in Asia. But coming back from that, I look back on that 18 months as the best 18 months of my career. But coming back on that, I realized I had a lot of friends in the industry from SPE, and they all wanted to know what I did. They all kept track of me on my blog that we published while we were there. It was pretty great. And so I'm just thrilled to have the opportunity to be SPE president. I decided a long time ago that I'm not really going higher in my career ladder. If you report to the COO or the CTO, there's only a level or two up, and I'm not going to be the CEO of any companies. But I am going to spend my life in service, because it was such a great feeling to serve others and help others. And so not just doing humanitarian work, but for me, the right kind of service, the kind I'm good at, is helping students and young professionals and mid-career professionals and encouraging people and trying to talk about the value of what we do. Every single measure of quality of life is correlated to energy usage. When I was out there in Asia, I saw things through the eyes of a petroleum engineer. I saw the impact not having safe, affordable energy has on people's lives. I saw the impact of having a pump available, having lights available. The difference between having safe, affordable energy and not having it is immense. And everything we do, we need to stay focused on enabling safe, affordable energy, because that really improves people's lives. So I want to encourage people that way, and I want to be a cheerleader for our industry, and as well help make sure SPE stays relevant and useful through this downturn. We don't know how long this downturn is going to last. I've been on downturns that lasted a year and a half, and I've been on them that lasted 6 years. People forget that from the day I was born to the day I got my first car, oil was $3 a barrel. So it can be flat for a long time. And it was. The world is different now. But in 1985, not many people thought we would stay at $20 a barrel as long as we did. We just don't know. And we're going to have to be successful delivering energy no matter what the price is.
Well, thank you so much for your service. And also thank you for this interview.
Okay, thank you.
Pleasure speaking with you.
Okay. And of all